Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark. And this week, we're going to break down the newest Trump voter's first impressions of his second term. And we are going to do it right here in our studio, which is crazy, with Sam Stein, who is sitting next to me, who is, what's your title?
Managing editor. You gave me the title. I just want to be clear. I didn't take it. It was given.
Okay, great.
Earned.
Well, it's a great title.
Yeah, no.
I love that title. Whoever gave it to you was very smart.
Smart person.
That's
wise,
right.
Wise, insightful. Good judge of character.
Okay, so there was a lot that went on this first week. There was the January 6th pardons and the freeze on federal assistance, hundreds of executive orders, and a bunch of bizarre and threatening moves by Trump's new political appointees. But if you're waiting for Trump's first week actions to put a dent in his poll numbers, you are probably going to have to keep waiting because Trump is getting a muted version of the traditional presidential honeymoon period. Mm-hmm. So, guest Sam Stein, managing editor of The Bulwark.
Yeah.
What'd you make of Trump's first week?
Both outrageous and expected, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we all sort of anticipated that he wasn't going to come in and be anything different than he was, right? In fact, we sort of anticipated that he would feel really emboldened because in this case, he won the popular vote. He feels vindication. He feels a thirst for revenge because of what happened between leaving the White House and returning to it. And I do think there's something to the idea, as cliche as it is, that he knows his way around Washington much more than he did in 2017. And he has all these people who are coming with him who have specific designs for the government. And then on top of that, you add another element, which is he's brought in all these like egotistical tech bros who feel like they should be, you know, given the keys to the kingdom and are great disruptors and visionaries, and that, you know, the government's just such an antiquated idea and they just need to completely revamp it. So all those ingredients really have added up to an incredibly disruptive, deliberately chaotic, and extremely active first 10 days. And I understand why he is getting a bump. I think, you know, people are sort of like, it's funny because in the lead up to the election, the thing that made me think that Trump was going to win, and maybe I was alone in feeling that way. Well, I wasn't alone, but the main thing that made me feel that he was going to win was that a lot of people who I regard as sort of like ordinary, sane, common sense people in my own personal life were exhibiting a level of comfort with the idea of him coming back into office that they never would have exhibited before. Now, they weren't necessarily saying we're going to vote for the guy, but they were, you know, curious about it. And if those people who I thought were sensible, rational-minded people had that level of comfort, then I feel like, you know, that's what makes the type of honeymoon period that he's enjoying.
Yeah, I think that's right. So the groups that we did this week are Biden to Trump voters.
Yeah.
And that includes many people who voted for Hillary Clinton and then Biden
right. And
now Trump, which means they've taken a pass on, like an active pass on Trump multiple times. But like now they have increased comfort with him.
Right.
Right. So like this is an interesting group of people to me because they're not part of a cult. They're not like
clearly not, yeah.
MAGA, you know, devotees. But they are people who've gone on a journey from kind of like, I don't know, I always voted Democrat to – well, the media told me he was racist or, right. You know, I heard that he was crazy or I just couldn't imagine. But they had this sense of, but I bought into that propaganda and this time I didn't.
Right. And it's this whole notion of like the word disruptor, which is like, you know, in normal times, maybe you don't want disruption, right? Like I like things to be steady. You know, now disruptor has become kind of co-opted to mean like, let's get shit done. And that's, again, the tech Silicon Valley lingo is disruption and, you know, break shit. And I think Trump has adopted that. And I think these people kind of are gravitating towards it, which is, you know, things weren't really working out or they didn't feel like they were working out. Things felt really bad. Stuff seemed really expensive. The world seemed on fire. Like, why should we stick with the status quo? Let's go with the disruption. And that's why when you have 10 days, and frankly, if we're just being honest about it, incredibly chaotic, disruptive, borderline incompetent 10 days. But for these people, I think they're going to give him some liberties to do this stuff because they just think that he should do this type of stuff. He should disrupt Washington. You shouldn't stick with the status quo. And so he'll have a bit of a runway.
Yeah, let's listen to this sound because it really backs up a lot of what you're saying. And it's been interesting to listen to these voters who they're seeing what Trump is doing and they are doing much less evaluating him on the quality of what he's doing or their assessment of what he's doing and much more on the fact that he is visibly doing something that they can like see and like they know he's doing something. So let's listen.
Like on Facebook, my feed is all about the borders and immigration. And then also too, I think the biggest thing was stops on all the federal. So, you know, a bunch of people have their opinions and freedom of speech. I'm all for that, but it's almost like too much. Like, you know, people are giving their opinions before you can really figure out what is really truly going on. So I think people are getting bad impressions and you go in and read the comments, you know, it's like, oh, they're taking away all these programs for people. And it's just a lot, you know? And so it's like, you have everybody giving opinions and those are the people who did not vote for Trump, you know, which is fine because they're going to be very critical and people have that platform that they feel like they can be. And I feel like do the research, make your own opinion.
I was tuning in to the press briefing earlier and I saw the press secretary mention that DOGE and the Office of Management and Budget found that the Biden administration was about to send $37 million to the World Health Organization and $50 million to fund condoms for Gaza, apparently. So I think it was just like a money laundering thing that the last administration was doing. But in terms of Trump's first week in office, I think he's pretty much telling every world leader that he's still unpredictable and do not mess with him because he will come at you with some tariffs or other economic sanctions that you haven't seen before.
I work in clinical research and there's a lot of NIH grants and things like that. And a lot of people are just confused. I work for a hospital, so I'm not scared about my job, but I know if I was working over there, I would be. But yeah, we've been halted communications. And it's just like, well, what do? We have no idea. The CEO has no idea. We're confused a little bit. And I'm not saying it's the right move, the wrong move. I don't know a ton, but it's definitely like something's happening. He's actually doing something. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he said he was going to do something and he's doing it.
It's like drinking from a fire hose right now with all the news that's coming out. So it kind of just trying to pick and choose your battles and figure out what you want to pay the most attention to is what I'm trying to do right now.
My first impressions, I think they're good because you're seeing action. I've gotten used to politicians getting in office and nothing gets done. Like, you know, they always talk about first 90 days. And it's not really an effective first 90 days. I feel like his first 9 days are equivalent to some politicians' first 90. You're seeing the things that he said he was going to do start to get done, especially immigration. That was a big thing. I'm here in New York as well, too. I've had some personal issues with migrants that were, you know, doing criminal activity that was getting out of hand. So seeing that actually ramping up from day one, okay. As far as the federal grants and funding freeze, I mean, listen, we have to all remember, like, Trump's a businessman, and I think that's the point about him that I always liked. And I think he's running the country like a business. So what happens if management steps into a business for the first time? Shut everything down. Let's see the books. Let's look at everything. Let's see what needs to stop being spent on and what. So I understand that. It sounds scary, the funding freeze. And I know it does like shake up a lot of industries or a lot of places, but it's something that needs to be happening. Like, I just recently had work done on my house, right? Quick analogy. And had a plumbing issue, but I just had the walls done. So the plumber came and he ripped open the same walls I just fixed. And I walked from out the bathroom and walked and I was like, what the hell? And he's like, you want it fixed or you don't want it fixed? So you got to tear the wall down if I want to fix it. And I feel like that's kind of, I don't know if that's a great analogy to make, but yeah, no pun on the wall.
I really like Trump's like strength about the ICE thing and like pretty much enforcing the law. And I was just like, yesterday, Like I was gonna go to the train to go somewhere, and my mom said, "Don't forget your ID." And I was thinking, "Oh, for work? Like just to be in the meeting?" She's like, "No, because of ICE." I was like, "Damn, man, that really is true." Like Trump is really pushing, and I was like, "Yo, kudos to him for like you know wanting to help the nation, you know, get clarity and be safe."
All right, so that last sound was really just scratching the surface on what we heard from these groups on the immigration front. And we're going to do a deeper dive on that in the coming weeks. We're going to do like a whole immigration episode because there was so much content. I'll tell you what, I don't know if you guys are seeing them in your communities, but I'll tell you in the focus groups we've been doing, people are seeing the ICE trucks everywhere.
Really?
And they're not delivering ICE to them. They are. They had different type of
ICE.
Are they?
What's the general? I don't want to get too far ahead, but what's like the general response? Are they grateful that there's enforcement?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be in the sound next week, but it's basically them being like, "So they're serious. They're really doing this, and like that's what this country needs."
Yeah.
They're second generation, maybe first generation.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Because it's in their communities,
right?
But they're very much for it. So I just want to say, Trump's approval rating right now sits just above 50%,
right.
Which is wild because that guy never found water over 42%, basically like the whole time he was there last time. However, his approval rating is significantly higher than his favorability rating. Now, hold on. I mean, this is important where he's still sort of slightly underwater.
Right.
And I think this is a matter of people being like, I don't like him, but I like what he's doing.
Right.
And what we're hearing in there is people giving him a lot of credit for like, he's doing something.
Yeah. Well, even the NIH grantee that was on there, that was, I thought, really interesting because she's like, well, I depend on these grants. It's very disruptive to lose grant money. My industry could tank, and I'm hearing no information whatsoever. But he's got to do something. It's like, to me, that seems insane, right? Like, I would want some stability, especially in biomedical research. It's not just you want immediate stability. You need like 5-10 year stability. And here's this guy who's just totally ripping things up. And you're like, okay. But again, it's basically seeing action. It's this idea that action is a value add and that almost like, you know, drama is a draw. And I think, I don't know how much the 4 years of Biden where you just didn't see any presidential leadership at all has fed into this idea. And this is just a big pendulum swing. I do know that as an ethos, the Trump people believe like they should just be omnipresent and that they should be always setting the agenda, that they should always be out there. And that helps them dictate the terms. The problem is when events supersede it. And I think you're starting to see Democrats recognize that and realize that they can't just simply sit back.
Are you seeing them recognize that and know that they can't sit back?
Yeah, two instances that come to mind. I'm not saying that they're good at it. But I think it's beginning to dawn on them that they have to be more active. So the first couple of days of the California wildfires, there was absolutely no pushback from Gavin Newsom or Karen Bass or any of them. And then something very interesting and telling happened, which is Gavin Newsom began going on his own Twitter feed and doing instantaneous Twitter response and video response through his Twitter feed in a way that he had not done. And it is very evident, and I talked to people in California who were like, yeah, he knows he needs to be in the cycle more because they're just pounding him and he's not responding. So that was one thing. And then we're taping this on a Thursday after Trump went to the press briefing room to talk about the horrific plane crash. Trump went to the podium, the lectern, and blamed it on DEI and Pete Buttigieg for being gay. And so, you know, in normal times, everyone would be like, what the hell is he talking about? Pete Buttigieg, within 3 minutes, was out there being like, this is ridiculous and outrageous. And, you know, he instantaneously responded. Now, Pete's pretty good and adept at this stuff. He happens to be one of the younger members. But then you're seeing, like, older members, like Richard Blumenthal was doing, like, weird, didn't really work. But it was at least an effort to, like, do straight-to-camera talks about some of these nominees. So you're starting to see some recognition that they have to be more active in the news cycle. But again, I think to the point of the focus groupers, it's like they see him. They see him moving. They may not like it. They may think it's a little bit wild and risky, but they like the idea of someone taking action.
That's right. I talked about this a little bit with Evan Ostos when he was on. But he had interviewed me for a piece a long time ago. And one of the things I was talking about at the time that was just so evident in the focus groups was Donald Trump adjusted people's like nervous systems.
Right.
To be like, no, I'm going to have a president who's in my face all the time. And there were people who would be like, and I hate that, but they did get used to it.
Right, but Joe Biden's win in 2020 was premised on the idea of, I'm not going to be in your face. Like, this is too much. You need to – so it goes both ways. But it also reminds me of the last time – or one of the last times I was on the show. We were talking about Kamala Harris. No one knew anything about her.
Right.
And clearly that was a huge impediment for her when she became the nominee, because she was just tucked away and doing nothing and she wasn't out there. And any impression of her was going to be formed by her opposition.
Yeah.
And I think one of the real lessons of her campaign was, you know, risk averse politicians are not going to succeed in this type of media ecosystem. And her unwillingness to get out there in that month after she was the nominee really did end up harming her.
I want to say that that premise of, you know, we're going to return to normalcy. Normality is actually the correct grammatical. But I'm more correcting the fact that return to normalcy is like actually like a designated historical time period that drives me crazy because it's not grammatically correct. But that's a personal problem of mine.
No, don't worry. This is your podcast. You do what
nobody else needs to engage with at all. My point to Evan was just like, yes, people would sort of say they didn't want it. But the revealed preference, I think, is that they do need some sense of constant communication to feel like somebody's talking to them. You know, listening to voters on the Democratic side as we were doing kind of the post-game, you'd be like, well, what did Joe Biden do? And everybody like kind of remembered that he did the vaccine rollout and then nothing else. And it was because there's not this constant communication.
Yeah.
So this here of just, I sort of don't care what he's doing. I just want him to do things. And the fact that he's doing things, even if they're the things maybe I don't like, makes me glad to see the action.
Yeah.
It's to me an interesting window into the very basic human psychology.
Yeah, I got to tell a small little nugget because I wrote a piece on this right before the inauguration about how Biden's real shortcoming was not just his inability to use the bully pulpit, but his unwillingness to be forceful. And by that, I mean he didn't make big demands of allies or enemies. He was a negotiator and he liked to work behind the scenes. He didn't have dramatic gestures. And I spoke with ex-representative Tom Malinowski about it. And he had this anecdote about Biden just refusing to demand that Democrats vote on his infrastructure bill. But then he had this other thing. He's like, it's a shame that like he didn't like make them feel pain for opposing the infrastructure bill more. He's like, if I was running the party, I would have like found like the districts where like there was the worst traffic in the country, and I would have put up billboards being like, tired of being stuck in traffic, blame Representative X who voted against. You know, like just simple ways that Trump definitely would do that just reminds people that you took action and they opposed it. And I think ultimately that was really the downfall. And really, honestly, Trump's smartest insight about politics is that you can oversaturate and get away with it.
And I'll go right back. I was thinking the same thing about the crash. Last night after it happened, the decent human thing to do in those moments is just be like, this is awful.
Right.
And there were some Democrats who I think were tempted to be like, hey, Trump did this hiring freeze. Trump's been disrupting things. Maybe it's his fault. And they got sort of hounded about being bad people and like took it back.
They noted that the FAA header had been pushed out by Elon Musk, that there was a hiring freeze. They wondered, hey, you know, isn't this inappropriate? And they were just scolded hardcore. And then 10 hours later.
And then what does Trump do? So then Trump calls the cameras in. He gets in front of the lectern. Yeah. He just holds a freewheeling, wheels off, idiotic press conference and blames DEI with no evidence. And the reporters are even being there saying, what evidence do you have of this? And he's like, dumb question.
He said common sense.
Common sense. You know, you listen to these voters, and I just, having listened to them now for 5 years, sometimes people are like, what's the number one thing that you've like learned from listening to voters? And it's just like how little they're paying attention to any of this.
I don't know. So, these people seem to be paying attention.
But here's the thing. One guy knew about the 50 condoms.
Yeah.
He will walk around for the next 4 years being like, yeah, you know, they got it under control. You know, they were doing condoms. You know, they were doing 50 million in condoms.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's completely false.
Of course it's false.
So here's the thing.
But I did like that the person before him was like, people need to do the research. And this guy's like, yeah, 50 million condoms in condoms. It's like
the second I hear the phrase, I learn to do my own research, I know I've got a Trump voter.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got a Trump voter. But no, it's not that they're not aware of things happening in the news. They are, but it's sort of like they catch the ephemera in this way. And so the depth of it's not particularly strong. Anyway, I just want to switch gears really quickly because so at this point in his presidency, Joe Biden was at like 54% approval rating and his disapproval was way low. So he was also getting a honeymoon period and he was doing way better than Trump is doing now. Yeah. Like Trump is sort of having a miraculously high
for him,
but it's not objectively high. But it tanked in August 2021, the Afghanistan withdrawal and the COVID resurgence. And it's also when inflation sort of started to tick up. Do you think Trump's, all the things we just talked about, do you think, though, it's durable for him? Or do you think there's overreach and eventual backlash?
Oh, definitely overreach and eventual backlash. Yeah, I take the respondent who was talking about the plumber shutting down the house. Let's take that analogy and just extend it further. Yeah, sure. Like, maybe it's important to, like, have a person go in there, rip up the walls, make sure you got the actual water under control. But what if that person goes in there, rips up the walls, but also happens to rip up all the pipes? And now your house is really flooding. Right? Yeah. Like, that is essentially what will happen if this federal funding freeze does happen. And sure, I think in, like, the first couple of days when it's abstract and it's just people warning about the possibilities of the federal funding freeze hitting, it's easier to be like, oh, people are overreacting. He's just taking action. He just needs to see the books. When people can't access Medicaid,
right?
When veterans are getting shut out from treatment, when people can't access their clinical cancer trials because the NIH is not funding them, when people are going hungry because SNAP benefits are gone, when people can't drop their kids off at Head Start programs, that's when shit hits the road. No, shit hits the fan.
And rubber meets the road.
And rubber meets the road and the shit hits the rubber or something. I saw there was a – and again, this is all anecdotal, but there was a TikTok video of this woman who is dependent on food stamps. And she got word – I don't think she's a Trump voter or anything like that, but she got word that those food stamps were going to be cut off. I don't know if you've seen this, but the fear – an emotion in her voice. She literally collapses because at the end of the month, she's totally dependent on food stamps and she needs to feed her kids. And so she goes hungry so that she can buy enough food that her kids can eat. And when she was told that those food stamps would stop, she like literally collapses and has like a panic attack. And it's all on TikTok. I think that stuff is palpable. I think that stuff actually does break through. And this is where the sort of upload it yourself media system really does actually matter because that stuff will get passed around. And I think one thing when you talk about overreach is that people might be listening and be like, ah, oh, what do they care about all these Social Security programs and social safety net programs? Well, a lot of Republicans are on food stamps. A lot of Republicans are on Medicaid. In fact, Medicaid, a lot of red states are way more dependent on federal funding for Medicaid than blue states.
Right.
This will hit Trump's voters. And Trump's coalition is also based upon the idea that poor Democratic voters, working class Democratic voters, actually have come into his coalition and want him to take on the elites. And if he's seen as giving over the government to Elon Musk, who then takes out the social safety net from them, I think that's a potent line of attack against Trump that really could hurt him. I don't think it's going to happen in 10 days, but I do think he will overreach.
Yeah, although I will say one of the things that has been striking, I brought it up on the show before, is how much people like Elon Musk that he's listening.
I thought his numbers were getting worse. Like so the negatives were going higher.
I do think it might be specifically in this cohort of people who have sort of been light, not particularly partisan Democrats, but like regular Democrats.
Yeah, it's the Tesla drivers who actually are souring on Musk.
Yeah,
right?
they're souring. But I think there was in these groups sort of a lot about, man, we need to innovate. And like AI is coming, especially you hear it from younger voters. We're like, I'm glad he's listening to people like Elon because we got to, you know, move into the future and we need people thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, totally cool. And let him do AI and let him do NASA. Like, awesome. Let him do actually, you know, what he's supposed to do, which is digital and technological upkeep in the federal government. Like, we have antiquated systems.
Yeah, not upkeep. That is where
replacement.
They're on paper systems still.
It's clearly necessary, and I welcome his involvement in that. Like, the U.S. government technology is antiquated and horrible. I think it gets a little bit dicier when Elon is, you know, going into OMB and being like, let's fire all these people or at least give them buyouts that may or may not happen. And I think, again, back to the airline crash, if shit starts happening beyond just airline crashes, a train derailment, or we have an avian flu outbreak, right? And you start taking people, health inspectors, food inspectors, people who are studying these diseases away, and then something bad happens, it doesn't take much to connect the dots.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Negative personal consequences will be the thing. So
events matter, right?
It, people will have to experience negative personal consequences, things that are mind-changing.
Right.
And, you know, there's actually been reports about the freeze, like the White House didn't know about it because they're trying to distance themselves politically from it because Trump doesn't like to do politically unpopular things.
Right. There were some interesting leaks in there. It was like Stephen Miller was really upset because, like, someone at OMB, potentially Elon, was like involved in and didn't get clearance. Like, oh, they're already fighting each other.
Yeah, that's right. There's going to be a lot of that.
Yeah.
All right. So now I want to zero in on a few of Trump's other executive orders that were kind of big deals in the last 10 days. One of them rolled back DEI programs throughout the government. And while they weren't clear on the ins and outs of what that was going to mean, it was pretty clear that this order hit a nerve. Like,
They liked it.
No, they liked it. Let's listen.
Try to see, like, see things from other perspectives. But that's just me being a black man. Like, I don't want, like, to be hired just because I'm black. I want to get hired because I deserve the job. I want to earn, you know, everything that I get. I don't want a handout. But at the same time, I can understand why, you know, in certain, like, career fields or certain industries, you know, there might be a need for more inclusion of diversity, but I'm not for including that diversity at the risk of having quality workers. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I just try to see all perspectives of things. You know, I'm glad I'm not the one making the decision. So
I'm a 6 foot tall, 160 pound woman trying to be, you know, carried down by a 4 foot tall lady. I want the big guy throwing me over the shoulder and grabbing my cat on the way down. Thank you.
We need to have oversight anywhere when you have bias going into hiring, right? So if you're going to be biased towards a race or something, that shouldn't exist. But when we're talking about government places like fire department, when we're talking about things that are there to save lives, right? You want the best of the best, right? I want the best firefighter. Of all the firefighters, I want the top ones if I'm going to be safe. Say I get caught in a fire or whatnot. I know there's a big issue with the California fires. But if somebody's coming up and being like, they can't get me out of the house, and then I just die because they had to make that decision.
I work for a company that does a lot in DEI. And for better or worse, and I think there is going to be a lot of talk about that in the future. It doesn't seem like it'll impact my company a whole lot right now, but you know, the language adjustments and all the things that they've done, all the government websites, that's all the visual stuff, but there's a lot of repercussions that are going to happen. I see the point, and I see the fact that, you know, having all these DEI wordage and things is making it more restrictive almost.
So that guy's company somehow works in DEI, but he does not like DEI. And I'll tell you what, in the focus groups with swing voters, independent voters, obviously the right-leaning voters, DEI, woke, trans stuff, and we're going to get to some of that a little later in the show, but like, people are down on it. And so Ezra Klein said this thing that I think I agree with so hard, which is that Trump won the culture war by a much higher margin than he won the election.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very right. And I think there's a reason that Trump jumped in front of cameras to blame literally this crash that is horrible, horrific, and that nobody has any idea what the cause of was yet, and blamed it on DEI, because he believes DEI is so wildly unpopular that if he does that, you get people immediately being like, oh, I wonder if those pilots were women, or I wonder if they were black, or gay, or some other thing where they were not qualified. Because you hear people in there saying, good, diversity, and I want people to get hired and everything. But also, like, if you're a firefighter, or you're a cop, or you're something, you know, you're Pete Hegseth, this was like the central thesis of his standards thing, even though he's grossly unqualified. This is something Americans seem like they're done with the DEI stuff. Is that your sense?
Oh, yeah, like 100%. It's almost a bit jarring how quickly that pendulum has swung in this direction, where it's hard to even see an affirmative defense of DEI coming from a major politician. Hakeem Jeffries was out there saying that it is sort of the DNA of Democrats to believe in the importance of diversity. But there's not really anyone actively saying, no, we should keep DEI programs. It is a huge political loser right now, and it's a great and convenient scapegoat for Trump to blame any single problem. And look, I think you look at his slate of nominees for cabinet positions, I don't think people would say they are there on merit, unless the merit is that they, you know, are good on Fox News.
Sure.
And some of them are very good on Fox News. So we should call this what it is. It's fake anger with DEI. It's not about pro-merit. And of course, a lot of it is racism. And I think we should call that what it is and be very clear about it. But that doesn't take away from the reality, which is that he ran effectively against it. He really tapped into a pool of voters, predominantly, not exclusively, young white men who believed that their circumstances in life are poor, and they're poor because they've been passed over for the sake of, you know, diversity, and that he harnessed that and was able to effectively use it to win election. And so, no, I mean, I was not shocked at all by those responses.
I'll say two things jumped out at me. One, and this is also not unusual, that group is predominantly black and brown. Like this focus group.
It's the same thing as those Hispanic voters, second-generation immigrant voters who are like, yeah, kick them out. I made it on my own. And there's a little bit of lack of self-awareness in those responses. But like, if you are here and you feel like you've, you know, had to claw your way up, you're not going to look kindly upon people who you think don't have to go through the same hurdles that you did.
I've just heard this from a lot of voters, especially black voters, who say, I do not want people to hire me because of my skin.
Right.
Not that I don't think there's racism, but I'm saying I want to be hired for my skills and not for this. And so, like, I just hear that specific pushback to DEI all the time, which I think is actually breaking through. And one of the reasons Democrats are loath to defend it is actually, while they hear the defenses from, like, maybe the people who lead some of the affinity groups and say they represent these constituents, like, if you listen to voters, they're just like, I don't want this. I don't like this.
Right. I get it. And I think that's why Trump was able to make really strong inroads with black men.
I agree. And the other thing that jumped out at me is several people used firemen as—
Why firemen?
I think because they're in California.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think because of the fires, and I think because just like the crash—
Trump blamed DEI.
Trump blamed DEI.
Yeah. I'm not an expert, but it did seem like 80 per mile, 100 per mile winds in a bone dry climate because it hadn't rained in like 10 months probably was more significant than like the random lesbian fire.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yeah. But they went hard on the like,
and they're gonna keep
lesbians did this.
Yeah. They're going to keep doing it until it, you know, they can wring every last drop out of it. I mean, it raises obvious questions. Like, for instance, after today, if Trump believes that DEI was responsible for the FAA's fuck up, like, should we not fly? I want to make sure there's no DEI before I get on a plane.
I got to tell you, I was flying with someone not that long ago, and the plane was having an issue. It was like there was a fuel leak, and so we had to like deplane.
Yeah, DEI.
And it was like, the person was like, did you notice it's an all-woman crew?
Oh, come on.
I was like, good, they noticed that the fuel line was leaking,
yeah,
so we didn't fly on the plane. They seem good.
Oh, we're in a bad place.
Okay, so another Trump executive order that had voters talking that they seemed aware of was the one recognizing male and female as two sexes, especially in government documents and like ordering the government to refer to people only by their biological sexes and not their gender identity. And I want to play what these voters thought about that.
Like, I can't really defend the whole 1,000 gender thing. I mean, it did become ridiculous after a while. Like, if you want to be trans female or trans male, whatever, do what you want. It's not hurting me in any way, shape, or form. Just don't push those agendas onto other people, especially kids who don't need to be hearing that shit. And they have bigger things to worry about, like getting good grades and making friends and doing their homework on time and not having to worry about, hey, there's non-binary, there's whatever hell else there is. Like, it's at the end of the day, like, I don't want to get into like health shit, but you either have male genitalia or you have female genitalia. If you see yourself as another gender, whatever, I mean, at the end of the day, God gave you what genitalia you had.
When my daughter was in the fifth grade, they had this whole conversation about what your pronouns are. And so, like, I was routinely, like, scolded for not respecting my daughter's pronouns as they, them. And I'm like, that's not something that's going to happen in this house. I gave birth to a daughter. It says it on her birth certificate. She's a girl. Show me her chromosomes where she's an XYY or a YYX or whatever. There is a DNA structure of people who are literally transgendered. It is a medical term. However, what we know to be and have labeled accordingly, as transgendered isn't a medical transgender, it's an identity. thing. And you know what? This is the same girl who wanted to be Spider-Man 3 years before that. So she doesn't have the capability of deciding what she wants for breakfast, let alone adding a penis.
I don't know how many of this group have children, but it's like a issue that I didn't even address. But having to explain to my 12-year-old daughter the litany of sexes, or I don't even know what to call it. I'm confused. That's the thing. I'm used to being able to answer questions to my kid, and like, daddy knows everything. So when she asks questions about the genders and all of that, and I'm just like, ask your mother. You know, ask your mother.
I have two children, and they're teaching me things about that.
It's something from my daughter. It was something from school. She told me that a child in her class is transitioning. And I was like, what does that mean? And I never asked my daughter questions. To actually ask, like, what do you mean? But she's transitioning, like, transitioning grades. She's like, no, she's transitioning. No, she said they are transitioning. So really confused me. And I was just like, so talking about it, I was like, you know, it was a question asked to me. I asked her back questions. And then 2 minutes into the conversation, I was like, wish this didn't even come up, because it's just so much. And that's how I was raised, that there's two sexes, male and female. So, you know, see why I would vote for a president. That's what he does. He's doing. I get it. It's a hard thing to explain to children. And I don't want to say, yeah, it's just hard to explain to children.
Go ahead. Do you have an immediate reaction?
Yeah, I do. Actually, okay. It just dawned on me that these reactions, if you could have gone back 25 years, it would have been about kids coming out as gay in their class, right? It would have been parents freaking out that the classroom culture had allowed kids to be more comfortable with the idea of being gay. And I'm not saying that it's the same exact thing. It's just sort of the potency of a parent who is viscerally worried about his or her child's sexual identity is remarkable. And I think it will drive these types of reactions and responses. You know, I get where Trump was coming in from a political perspective on this, because those people are like speaking from a position of deep fear about what's happening. Now, Trump, of course, dramatically exaggerates everything and says like there's like gender affirming surgeries happening in schools, and like he's got to stop it because you go in as a boy, you come out as a girl, and no one knows. And that's obviously not the case. And
I think if that happens, you've got the wrong kid.
Yeah, or the wrong school.
Yeah, you took the wrong kid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I just couldn't help but think about when I was growing up and the conversations being around, why are kids turning gay in school and things like that? And culture evolves, right? The kids who are in our school system now are going to be much more open to the idea of transgenderism, and they will be more politically potent and active in 20, 30 years, but we're just not there yet.
I guess so. I graduated college in 2002. Gay marriage happens in the first state in 2005. Right. In that period of time, like, I'm sort of coming out. And so I listened to people of good faith, I feel like, talk about that issue. And then I worked on sort of persuading people on the issue over those years around Don't Ask, Don't Tell and around marriage. And one of the things that I found to be a very authentic and inoffensive reaction was sort of what this guy's doing, which is like the confusion.
Right.
Like,
they don't get it.
They're not like expressing actual like hostility.
No.
And I actually hear this in a lot of the groups where they're like, and a bunch of people said this in this group. It was like, you want to be trans? Like, be trans. Like, but it really does seem to be this thing about, and I identify with this to some degree, about how you talk about it with young kids.
Right.
Because I do think they're starting to talk about this stuff with kids of ages where it is, like, absolutely not appropriate. Yeah. And I also just wish, rather than us maybe getting so invested on, like, one area of this thing, that we really just taught kids, like, hey, man, we're all different. We're part of this beautiful tapestry of humanity. Be decent to each other. Understand each other's differences. Like, you can teach the broader themes without being like, let me teach you your pronouns.
Right, exactly. And I think they're frightened in the responses. They're frightened that they don't understand what this means. They're unfamiliar with what transitioning is. They fear that their kids are being indoctrinated and, you know, they have no sense of what an actual transition entails, and that they're going to lose control of their own family, and that society is pushing this on them when they don't want it. And I think anytime that that's the case, you're going to have people really clam up and get anxious. And you can tell it in their voices. And this is sort of like the Archie Bunkerism of Trump, right? He's like, it shouldn't be this way. It wasn't always this way. Why can't we just go back to being normal? And people kind of feel that way too, where it's like society's changing way too rapidly for them and they don't like it. And the family unit and the family structure is changing in ways that they don't like. Their kids are not, you know, outside playing sports. They're on their screens. Their kids are not getting good food. This is the Maha stuff. The kids are not getting good food like they did. They're not being taught self-reliance like they were. They're being indoctrinated with cultural leftism and transgenderism, and it's all kind of falling apart culturally and at the familial unit. And here's a guy who says, enough of that. Let's restore what we had. And in a kind of weird irony, he's the one who is promising them stability.
Yeah.
Right? He's saying, I'll be the disruptor to give you stability. And they're willing to pay the price for this huge disruption so long as they have stability on the sort of micro level.
Yeah. Give you a half-baked thesis around overreach and backlash. Because it's just on this topic still. I think that there has been overreach on sort of DEI and gender politics that goes to things like everybody having their pronouns in their emails or things like that, where people are like, what are we doing here? Like, what is happening? And I think that that overreach has led to this backlash. And I'm concerned where the people are like hateful and looking for ways to just attack trans people.
Oh, yeah.
That part is extremely disgusting and is on one part of the spectrum. There's the other part of the spectrum that I feel like is kind of human, where people are like, be however you want, but like telling me I've got to include my pronoun or I've got to, like, my fifth grader is going to get told that, like, they're going to identify as they, them, and I'm the bad guy for not saying that. I feel like that's a different thing, and that those people feel overreached and they are doing things that they feel like are corrective. But I don't necessarily think that this group, like, I didn't hear them hating on trans people. Trump is bringing out the worst, is my point. Like, he's trying to stoke the worst thing, where some of this stuff is just more like human and muddled.
Yeah, and I think the line is like sort of in a weirdly libertarian way. It's like, just if you can let me do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want you to impose anything on my family where I have to choose a pronoun, right?
Yeah.
Because you're offended by it. If I don't want to, I don't want to. You know, I want to be able to like talk to my kid the way I want to talk to my kid. I want to make choices with my kid and not, you know, hand that over to the school. That's one thing. But to sort of actively demonize and pick on trans people, to say, oh, the black and female FAA agent up in the, you know, Reagan airport was responsible for the crash with no evidence, that's another thing. And to your point about backlash and such, two things that stood out this week were, I think it was the Department of Defense is like getting rid of recognizing Juneteenth as a holiday.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of ironic because it was Trump who actually established Juneteenth as a federal holiday. He did so. And then he, of course, had to remove that rally, which was lying on Juneteenth during the COVID year because it was disrespectful. So it was like, yeah, that's the pendulum swinging back. The other thing was, it was an online conversation, but it was very illustrative to me, which was that PEPFAR, the program that George W. Bush started to fight AIDS in Africa, which has been a massive success, saved, you know, tens of millions of lives, if not hundreds, for a relatively small cost. Unobjectively good. Anyways, there was questions because of the federal funding freeze for a brief period of time. It was stopped because they were stopping every bit of foreign aid and programmatic funding. Like, the online discourse was like, oh, thank God. But then there was people who were like, why should we be spending this money? You know, curing AIDS in Africa. They're not Americans. And it's like, I have to believe, or at least I want to believe, that enough people are decent to say, you know what? We're the richest country in the world. It's a pittance of foreign aid, and we're actually doing good across Africa. Not only is it a morally righteous thing to do, but like it will rebound on us in terms of how the continent and our relationship and how they treat us. I have to believe people will ultimately say, no, the backlash against PEPFAR is bad, and in fact, we've gone too far in the pendulum.
So this was sort of the point that I was getting to, which is just that I think that Trump is getting to live on the good side of the backlash right now.
But
as he promotes the nastier side, the grosser side, the side that these people, they want their kids not being talked about trans stuff when they're young, but they don't want like hateful shit.
Right.
Like, I mean, some people do. They're like, oh, are they rounding up grandpa? Like, sorry, man. Like, I heard that in the group. But I also think that there are enough people where if Trump overreaches, people are just like, well, what are we going to do? And I'm like, well, you've got to show people stuff that they don't like and say, yeah, Trump's doing it. Like, he's failing you. He's betraying you.
Yeah.
It's his fault that there are these personal consequences. And also, isn't he a horrible person? Like, isn't it too much? But I'll just say on the AIDS thing, this America first mentality, the AIDS thing is Ukraine, is Israel. It is people saying there is a massive strain now around we need to take care of our own first. Man, do you hear that?
I can understand why you hear it, but I wonder if you like chisel down to the specifics. Like maybe they're not supportive of sending money to Ukraine because it doesn't, you know, just get a deal done so that we can like get out of there. Maybe they think, you know, some foreign aid is bad, but the idea of like, here's like a small sum of money relatively to like make sure people don't die. I have to imagine that if you just sort of explain that and laid it out in those simplistic terms that people be like, all right, I'm comfortable with that. Because otherwise, people will die, right? Like,
oh man,
maybe I'm.
You should listen to voters.
I gotta listen to my voters.
All right. Speaking of depressing things that voters think, to close, I want to get into the most egregious of the actions that we heard about this week, which was Trump's pardon of the January 6th.
Yes, I was waiting for that.
Defendants, so prepare to be disappointed. Let's listen.
Oh no, it's a hard one. Like, in one hand, I don't care about it because it's not really important in terms of changing the outcome of what's going on in America. But on the other hand, it just was bad optics, honestly. And that's something I don't think Trump could have ever won. He could have never won that situation. And the people that were there, and since the way the situation happened, it actually boiled into physical turmoil. It was only one way that would have been seen. And now that's just like, I don't know, that's almost like a holiday, I think, for like some liberals and Democrats, like January 6th. Like, it's just that day, like those two words.
I think that it was because of the fact that he probably feels like he incited it. And I'm sorry, it's not funny, but telling them to storm the Capitol and then they sort of just follow suit, kind of like puppets, really. And I don't look at it like a racial thing. I think that it was just from him thinking logically that they've already done, you know, the time for whatever they did, or, you know, they've been punished enough type of thing. Because he also pardoned Kwame Kilpatrick, who was the mayor here in Detroit that did all that stuff. I don't think that he looked at it from a racial standpoint at all. It's more like a logical thing. And so I don't feel one way or the other about it because it doesn't affect anything that I have going on.
From what I understand, Trump did request, I believe, from the mayor of D.C. to have the National Guard troops deployed, and they denied his request. From what I understand, that was exposed to be true. And I found that very damning. As somebody getting into security, getting ready to start my training for Homeland Security, like, that's a clear threat. And even with his assassination attempts, like, or a clear conflict of interest, I would say. And also with them having supposedly FBI agents or informants, undercover assets, we'll say, in the field on that day, and they not actually addressing this specific number. That is a direct conflict of interest if I've ever heard one. And I'm not that intelligent of a person to put that together.
Oh, sometimes people take what he says, and a lot of it has to do with the media. I mean, he pardoned them because, you know, he probably did feel guilty. That wasn't his intention. It's just, like I said earlier, he's just direct with his words. And, you know, a lot of people might feed into what he's saying and made their own assumptions at what he was trying to say.
I'm not going to get into whether what they did was right or wrong. I don't think that that was the way to carry out protest in this country. I mean, there's ways that you're supposed to do it. So they might have went a little a lot past boundaries. But I believe it was done on, you know, on his behalf. So I understand him pardoning. I think some of the sentences was a little harsh in comparison to, like, you know, if you look back at some of these individuals, like, with no criminal history and what they got sentenced to, it's like, okay. But it was expected. I feel like it was expected. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, all right, yeah, he's going to pardon those individuals. Like, they did that on his behalf, kind of.
They did something bad. I think they should have a punishment of some sort, like, just on the record. Hey, don't storm government buildings. But I do agree some of those punishments were too harsh and they were used to make a point. And yeah, those should have been reduced. I'm not sure it should have been a complete, like, clean slate, personally, just because we don't want everyone storming everywhere all the time. Especially deep down, they thought they were doing it correctly. And that is the truth. And as mentioned, that's how America was formed, is we have to take our rights into our own hands sometimes. But I just personally think, like, it's very clear they did something that they probably shouldn't have done. And maybe just a slap on the wrist or something, yeah. Not just a complete, hey, you're good.
I could be a little bit more lenient if it was something similar like trespassing, but if it's right. like assault and stuff like that, then yeah, they need to be held accountable for that. But at the same time, a few months earlier, I spent the summer 2020 trying to stay out of the cities because of the unrest. So it's kind of a double standard there as well.
All right.
Okay. So here's why I love focus groups more than polling. So we've seen a bunch of polls that show us that pardoning the January 6th yeah. defendants are unpopular. People don't like it. I bet if you gave these guys a poll and said, do you think Trump should pardon the January 6th people? They would say no, like complete pardons.
Right.
But do they care?
No, they don't
no.
care.
No. And that's right. why when people are like, oh, well, something's so unpopular, it misses intensity.
Yeah.
Because everybody here had either a what about, I mean, what about Black Lives Matter? I've been hearing that about January 6th
yeah.
from the jump in every group. Or they had a like, well, he felt bad. Things were too harsh. Like they had all their, you know, reasons.
So I agree that there's like nuance to their takes about January 6th. And it's interesting to hear it. And I totally agree, especially about the issue of intensity. And to me, it's just sort of simple. It's like something happened 4 years ago. These people at the time probably were repulsed by it or at least thought it was bad. But they're not going to like get super motivated about it because it no longer is a direct matter or materially significant matter to them. The idea of, oh, it's an attack on our democratic institutions, that's sort of vague for them.
You heard somebody saying there, like, doesn't affect my life.
It doesn't affect their lives. Yeah. And frankly, Trump won again. And that to them is like, oh, democracy survived. We've moved on. And I can imagine to them his pardoning of these people is to a degree closure, right? It's like, okay, that chapter is done. Let's yeah. stop looking at it. That's why I find it like interesting that Democrats were trying to like make a big stink out of this, as they should. It's an important issue. When the more interesting and potent issue for them is obviously going to be how is Trump's actions with the federal funding freeze or any others of these executive orders affecting daily people in their daily lives. You know, talk more about the price of eggs and the inability to like grasp what's happening with avian flu, less about political pardons and what happened on January 6th. I know it's like hard to hear for people who care about democracy and democratic institutions, but I just think the responses show that these people are not motivated by this issue.
Yeah. I think that's right, for better or worse.
But I don't think – it's funny because you said prepare to be disappointed – I wasn't totally disappointed. Like, these people clearly sensed that something was wrong. They weren't like, yeah, hell yeah, you should have done that. They're like, it was bad. And they kind of were trying to rationalize how they could sort of say, it was bad, but I'm not, like, motivated or moved right. by it. But they clearly thought it was bad. And evidently, like, they knew that he shouldn't have done it in a blanket form. So I was not totally surprised by what they said. It made kind of sense to me in a way.
Yeah. I guess I would just say – when you say closure,
yeah,
that sounds right to me. Like, I do wonder.
Yeah, enough of all that.
People are ready to look forward. Do you think Democrats should look forward?
Well, of course they should. I don't know if they're capable of doing it. They like relitigating stuff. And, you know, frankly, Trump never looks forward. Like, Trump brings this stuff yeah. up all the time.
True.
And so, you know, Trump and his people have the benefit of both accusing Democrats of looking backwards and they themselves never getting over the past. But I do think, like, the idea that January 6th is this great fault line politically, it is. And yet, in the years ahead, it cannot be. Like, yeah. we have moved past it.
All right. Sam Stein, managing editor of The Borg. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. I love this studio.
We should do it more okay. often. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of the Focus Group podcast. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Bulwark on YouTube and become a Bulwark Plus member at thebulwark.com. We will see you next week. Bye.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tomtandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.